you're going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching maqasid, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Sheikh Javed, let me ask you this question. Is it permissible for the leader of a congregational prayer or the imam to receive money, wages, salary, whatever?
Yes.
For doing preliminaries of the congregational prayer?
Well, we know that a prayer leader has to walk, you know, back and forth, you know. He has to be available. He has to, you know, take a taxi, and he has to prepare himself for the prayer, for the congregational prayer, of course. According to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, it is permissible to receive wages for the preliminaries. For the preliminaries, like for example, going to the mosque and taking a taxi, or let's say anything which can be considered preliminaries. Like what, for example, you know, you have to wash your turban, get ready, get dressed, and then go to the mosque. Sometimes, you know, you have to walk a long distance to reach. He can, for example, offer a Friday prayer, a congregational prayer at home or very close to his house without having to walk all the way to the mosque.
Yes.
But, you know, because of the mu'mineen, because of the, you know, the mosque having to have a prayer leader, he walks all the way to the mosque. And it is going to cost him, you know, sometimes some money.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it is permissible. But he cannot receive money for the prayer
for
the
itself.
Prayer,
yeah.
Of course, because prayer is wajib, and no one can receive any money or any wages for the prayer which he himself is supposed to offer,
mm-hmm.
or for teaching the Holy Quran, for teaching the prayer. For teaching something which is obligatory. If you want to teach it, you cannot, because teaching it is obligatory, and you cannot receive wages for teaching something which is obligatory.
What about the Quran?
The Quran, of course, is not teaching the, you know.
It is not obligatory.
It's not obligatory. So, of course, you can receive wages for teaching it. But if you want to teach the prayer, or teach something which is obligatory, then, of course, you
like
cannot.
Like fasting, for example?
Like fasting, yes.
I see.
If you want to teach people
how to fast, for example, or the conditions of fasting.
Generally speaking, anything which is obligatory,
mm-hmm.
receiving wages for something which you are supposed to do,
yes.
and which is obligatory on you to teach or to share with others, you cannot receive money for it.
I see. A very quick question, maybe I can squeeze in here before the break, Sheikh Javid. A congregational prayer imam rides a bicycle to the place,
yes,
or the mosque of congregational prayer. What is the ruling about, you know, following him, in fact, during the prayers?
Well, you know, some people might consider it kind of offensive to see someone or a prayer leader, you know,
riding
a bicycle to the mosque. There is no problem,
mm-hmm.
because it's a means of transportation, and riding a bicycle is not a sinful act. Nowhere can you find any, you know, reason to forbid a scholar, an alim, to ride a bike. You know, it's quite permissible.
And this is a modern vehicle, basically.
Yeah,
but in the Prophet's time, didn't the ashab, the followers, the companions of the Prophet use any kind of horses or donkeys to the mosque?
Why not? The Holy Prophet did perform the circumambulation of the house of Allah,
mm-hmm.
riding a camel.
Right.
Riding a camel, which is the holiest place on earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Prophet circumambulated, performed tawaf of the house of God, riding a camel.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, it was very common. There were camels,
yeah.
and walking around the Kaaba, and the people were also riding on their camels, performing tawaf. That was very common. But in this time around, you cannot see any animal,
yeah.
Getting close to the mosque, and it's considered offensive. Yes,
I see.
So, you know, the time has changed, and the requirements of time have also changed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this time, we have bikes, we have motorbikes, we have cars, and we have, you know, different means of transportation. So there is no objection to a scholar, to an alim or a prayer leader riding a bike, riding a motorbike, and driving to school, to the mosque,
right.
and going back home.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid is still our guest speaker in the studio. We are talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, can an imam,
yes,
the leader of a congregational prayer, say a single prayer twice in a congregation? For example, whether it be an Eid or a daily prayer.
Well, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, has said that as far as the five daily prayers are concerned, it is permissible for him to perform the same prayer again in congregation, but with another group of followers, not with the same followers, with the same people, you know, because you cannot, the people have already offered their prayers, mm-hmm. you know, to repeat the congregational prayer with the same people doesn't make sense, you know. But if there is another group of followers who have not offered their prayers and who want to offer their prayers in congregation, there is no problem and there is no objection to the same prayer leader leading their prayers. And according to His Eminence, it is, you know, it is mustahab to do so. But when it comes to Eid prayer, which is not obligatory in this time around, of course, His Eminence says that there is problem in doing so. So Eid mm-hmm. prayer is not wajib. You know, as for the five daily prayers, they are wajib. And of course, there is no problem and there is no objection to a prayer leader repeating the prayer for another group of followers. The Eid prayer is not obligatory in this time. And of course, there is problem, there is iskal in repeating it and offering it again.
Mm-hmm. I see. Another short question, Sheikh Javid, would be the fact that should a person, an individual, read the Fatiha or another chapter of the Quran loudly when he's doing the second rak'ah while the imam of the congregational prayer is in his third or fourth rak'ah of, let's say, Isha prayer?
Well, it is, forbidden for the person joining the prayer in the second rak'ah to recite or to perform his prayer loudly.
Yes.
Because, making noise will disturb the other people who are offering their prayers, who are in their third rak'ah or maybe who are in their fourth rak'ah. So to maintain silence is important, and not to disturb the Friday prayer, the congregational prayer is more important. Mm-hmm. And so it's not permissible for the person who is joining prayer and who is maybe who is in his first rakat or maybe who is in his second rakat to recite the zikr of the prayers and the verses and the ayat of the Surat Al-Hamd or Surat Ikhlas loudly. It's not permissible according to Ayatollah Khamenei.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening to the program Islam Gloss on IRIB English Radio. It's Muhammad Jawad signing out. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Mannanun
Return of the Nazi. Part 1.
Vorleben was a public figure, a functionary of the neo-Nazi NPD party, a right-wing activist, and a supporter of terrorists.
In July 2019, the Italian police discovered a huge stash of illegal weapons, a storage house which belonged to neo-Nazi groups, and every kind of weaponry could be found in it, even a French-made air-to-air missile which was sold to Qatar the previous year. It was unclear how this extremist group had come into possession of it. If this news was reported alongside a number of other news items, it might have had a different meaning. For example, alongside news of the vicious killings in Norway by someone who gave a Nazi salute. Or alongside news of violence against migrants in different European countries, or alongside images of politicians who insult the holy book of some of the citizens of their country, alongside gatherings, protests, riots, political scuffles, and big and small social crises.
In it, far-right activists violently clash with an anti-fascist group.
At least today, Europe does not look very well when it comes to media reports. Thousands of members of Pegida, who consider themselves opponents of the Islamization of the West, gathered in the city center of the German city of Dresden on Sunday. In a Europe which had reached unity with the establishment of the European Union, the erasing of borders, and the introduction of a single currency, today, whispers of nationalism are being heard louder, and some of these parties in some countries have been able to come to power, be it in the parliament or as prime minister or president. Basically, political movements take advantage of the fear of the people. Fear of war caused the formation of the European Union, and now that years have passed since the war and the new generation does not fear war among European countries, for example, war between Germany and France or war between the UK and Belgium, now political movements have been established which have created new fears for the people. When the famous Rudolf Hess was being convicted in the Nuremberg trials, he said he didn't regret anything. Now, his words have turned into the main slogan of Europe's radical right. They shout that they do not regret anything. But why? Of what? This is what I was after during this trip. Extremists have once again risen from the ashes of Berlin, but this time with a different look and color.
The ultras are the most extreme supporters. They've been around for years and are well known for their racist and neo-fascist gestures. They are proud to use the fascist salute in honor of Mussolini.
To my mind, there are many overlapping ideas also between our new right-wing parties and the traditional fascism.
It's always dangerous to compare because history doesn't repeat itself. But it's true that we have now what has been called the third wave of radical rights in Europe. It started at the end of the 80s.
They tend to be anti-Semitism tends to be strong among them. And we don't see much of that among the radical right parties like the Danish People's Party.
I think Americans supporting somehow right-wing populism tries to impose civil war in Europe, to return to the nationalism, to something like was the situation in the Second World War or First World War, in order to put Europe in turmoil and destroy it completely. To be torn apart by nationalisms.
The position of the far-right extremists is that the EU is a corrupt and bureaucratic union, something that has caused their countries to lose their borders, and their culture and identity are being attacked by illegal migrants. And that's why they expect that referendums are held as soon as possible and their countries exit the EU.
Our proposition, Eurasian proposition, multipolar proposition, is quite different. Not to destroy Europe, but construct the Europe on the basis of traditional civilization, on the European values, limiting mass migration and returning to the Christian or Roman, Greek, Roman identity, but not to the bourgeois capitalist nationalism that will finish Europe.
Once, someone told me that two things create today's Europe: shame of the events that happened and fear of the things that might happen. All the concepts that represent the EU, a common currency, a borderless continent, or extensive policies of accepting migrants, is this, the meeting of shame and fear. Like freedom, human rights, democracy, social responsibility, tolerance and peace, they are all a high wall in front of past nightmares, the dream of a world which is nothing like the mid-20th century.
Polling Institute says anti-Semitism is much more prevalent in the AfD than in other parties.
Marcus Fuchs, the longtime spokesman of the AfD party, a group with positions and activities which have become extremely controversial even in Germany. He's known as one of the most famous extremist right-wing personalities, even if he does not accept this himself. When Marcus was talking about his opinions, I did not feel they were irrational or scary. Who knows, maybe if I were a European citizen too, the things he said would be very exciting to me. Now I can understand why right-wing extremists are slowly taking over everywhere. The media, speaking halls, streets, and even parliaments.
If we try to understand the causes of the development of these far rights in Europe, there are many, but you can see two big categories. The first series is structural, long-term causes. It's a reaction to modernization, or more specifically what we call now, since the 90s, globalization. These rights have taken as their main platform the refusal of globalization, refusing the European integration, refusing the opening of borders. The second cause, and it's linked to it, is the delegitimization of the political class, of the mainstream parties, because there's the feeling that they're incapable of defending the country against globalization, which is seen as a cultural, economic, and political threat.
Far-right parties that now are gaining electoral support in Europe, they're kind of washing out these ideas with, they're cloaking it in another language. So one can say the language gets more and more narrative, more and more radical, the more you get into the underground. The other things are outspoken.
Because these rights, which had been delegitimized during World War II, wanted to reintegrate the parliamentary game. And for that, the only way to do it was to detach themselves completely from fascism and Nazism. And very quickly, they were called no more fascist rights, the right like the party of Jean-Marie Le Pen, created in 1972.
And at the beginning, it was a level of the public attention, the level of the public debate that condemned this sort of public expressions. And then, with the time, slowly, the level of criticism, the level of taboo, the level of public alarm on this kind of statements. And now it's... It's impressive how it's possible for a public, for example, a minister or a political leader, the chief of a political party, to publicly express.
There is an overrepresentation, but we should not exaggerate the extent to which higher educated and higher class voters would go to the more mainstream and lower educated people go to the radical right. Across the board, still, the majority of workers and lower educated people vote for mainstream parties. So we should not exaggerate that.
That have succeeded electorally are those who are the most far away from the model of fascism and Nazism, the old right, like the neo-Nazi small movements in Germany or the neo-fascist small movements in Italy, they don't take off electorally. And more recently, there's what you can call a fourth wave of far rights that have really no more connection with the past.
And these people who are beginning to find faith that the old beliefs about extremist rights are wrong are into taking action. For the first time after the Second World War, they sent representatives of a radical right party to the German parliament. Today, with younger and more charismatic leaders coming to power, the rights are slowly taking over the parliaments of different countries. What does the extremist right exactly want?
Or let's put it this way, what exactly doesn't the extremist right want? The story is very simple. For the extremist rights, national identity is very important, and they oppose anything which wants to weaken or deteriorate it. Now, that could be the arrival of migrants who they think are unlike and different from their society or being part of a union that, according to them, puts them at the same level as other countries and brings their national sovereignty under question.
National communities are exclusive, and that we have this very strong idea of nativism combined with racism and xenophobia, and also ideas about the strong state, that it is the state that takes care of its citizens, and that the citizens are citizens of that state because of their nationality, something they are born with.
Many citizens feel that there are too many migrants and that Western societies are changing too rapidly as a result of migrants entering the country. And radical right parties tap into these sentiments and these anti-immigration feelings, and that's what drives support for these kind of parties.
Now, Europe's fear and historical shame are gone, and this can bring the EU to its collapse. Tumult is on the rise on a daily basis in Europe. TV stations, platforms, the streets, everywhere is the scene of battle between the extremist right and their opposition. But today, we might be experiencing the foreshocks of a huge earthquake. This is where people might want to be the flag bearers of forces that want to return to the highest levels of power after years. Or at least, that's what many think. During the days I was wandering around in European cities and speaking with different experts, at times I would ask myself a question. As an Iranian, why would the re-emergence of the extremist right in Europe matter to me? Then I'd always come to a series of clear answers. I'd remember that in the past decade, a huge wave of people left the Middle East to reach Europe, including some of my own countrymen. I'd remember that extremist right-wing groups are against accepting migrants. I'd remember how entangled the policies of the European Union are with the destiny of my country, and that the right doesn't have the appetite to remain in the EU, and this itself can change a lot of things between Iran and Europe. I remembered that some of Europe's right-wing parties had strong relations with some of the most infamous terrorists in our country's history.
Populism, left populism or right populism in all European countries, now with populist left government in Spain, and growth of right populism of Vox there in Spain, and we have in all the country with Salvini in Italia, Salvini Fratelli d'Italia in Italia, AfD Alternative für Deutschland in Germany with Marine Le Pen. We see the European Union, it has already collapsed. So nobody could heal that. So there is no more, formally speaking, European Union.
During the 2 days that it took to make this documentary, these predictions came true. Today, Vox has 50 members in Spain's parliament and 3 in the European Parliament.
When it comes to explain the current situation, there are different theories around. One theory is it is fascism that is on the rise. Others argue it is nationalism.
Russia, please, if you can, get us Hillary Clinton's emails.
In a world where Trump is its most famous politician, dereliction of duty and trying to win over the most benefits are not strange. Just like fundamentalists in Islamic countries have a violent and illogical take on Islam, extremist rights are in favor of a fearsome proposal on modern capitalism. This 21st century proposal, even though different in each country, has commonalities as well. Extremist rights insist on their national identity. They do not want the European Union. They dislike migrants and letting them in. And they have serious positions against any group that challenges liberal traditions or creates disarray in the capitalism order. My trip to Europe didn't end with an answer. Instead, it made my questions more obvious. We are in the initial decades of the 21st century, and many believe that Europe is on the verge of returning to the situation of the first decades of the 20th century. If you don't forget that all world wars began from this beautiful continent, could these big and small weapon warehouses that pop up across Europe every once in a while, or these sudden killings which every once in a while shock the entire world, be a run-up to a huge nightmare? Is tomorrow the era of Europe's Trumps? These are questions that the green and beautiful continent of Europe has to answer, and we are all waiting for these answers. In a city which is the symbol of Europe, the symbol of France, we can see that there are a lot of tourists. But until when will this situation continue? Until when can tourists easily come here with a Schengen visa and see 20-plus European countries? And until when will all these migrants of African and Middle Eastern descent come and live and work here? And will the French vote for change, or will the current situation and unity in Europe remain? It was the end of the discussion, and before saying goodbye, Marcus was showing me his office. Then I saw something strange. I saw a photo of Marx, the biggest leftist theorist in the office of the most famous radical right-wing party.
This is a famous local poet, yeah? And his poetry was in the local dialect. So he's very famous in Frankfurt. For one sentence, es will man nicht in der Kopenai, wie kann ein Mensch nicht von Frankfurt sein? So it means I can't understand how can one not be born in Frankfurt.
But it seemed like they had made a mistake. Well, everyone in this world has his own manifest.
We come to this point that Sheikh Shaltut, good communication with Ayatollah Burujerdi in Iran, give this picture that how the head of Al-Azhar is establishing relationship and communication with the head of Shia in the world of Islam.
One of the very important points that Sheikh Shaltut insisted on it is that tried to have the gathering and the mourning ceremony for the martyrdom of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam in the day of Ashura in Al-Azhar University.
Be more familiar with outstanding figures in The Teacher.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Mahtavi.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about an outstanding Muslim figure from the Ahl Sunnah, from our Sunni brethren, who had role in establishing proximity among the different schools of thoughts of Islam inside the religion Islam. Also one of the main founders of Darul Taqrib Bainul Mazahib al-Islami. He is no one but Mahmoud Shaltut, mainly known as Shaykh Shaltut, the outstanding university professor and the scholar of Al-Azhar University in Egypt. Sheikh Mahtavi, let's start with you this episode. Give us some details about the early life of Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, born in 23rd April 1893. He was an Egyptian figure best known for his attempts in terms of Islamic reform and also Islamic unity, bringing about unification among different sects of Islam, mainly Shia and Sunni. Sheikh Shaltut, he was from one of the village of the province Behira, actually from one of the village of the Behira province in Egypt, and he completed his study in Alexandria, which was one of the affiliated religious institute of Al-Azhar. Since he was a very talented student, he was invited to Al-Azhar University to complete his study. So he received his bachelor in Al-Azhar and finished off his degree, PhD in Al-Azhar. So it was really important to be invited to Al-Azhar by the head or vice chancellor of the university at that time, who was Mustafa Al-Maraghi.
That's right.
He was invited to the University of Al-Azhar, and he had a very good cooperation with the head of the university because he believed and trusted Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut as one of the talented student and smart student. So I think this is a very important part of his life that we have to give more focus and thought, because later on, inshallah, when we discuss about the achievements being done and conducted by Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, we are really in need of knowing that he was a very talented, smart student that graduated from Al-Azhar, and he was not a kind of normal student to graduate from the university. Why I'm saying these stuff, because when we reach inshallah later on in the following parts of our discussion for today, we will talk about the great and outstanding role that this student played in the world of Islam.
That's right. Okay, thank you, Sheikh Mahmoud. Sheikh Ziyaniya, give us a picture of his Taghribi attempts. Because his main, interest was Taghrib al-Madhahib, and the look that he had at Jafariya school of thought in that time made him very much famous among the Shiite school of thought too. One of our Sunni brethren, gave us a fatwa or a jawaz, a permission that we can say acting and practicing Islam according to the Jafariya school of thought is allowed, and this and that. I think this made the role of Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut very much great. But what was happening before him, in the world of Islam? First give us that picture, and then we'll get to the attempts of Sheikh Shaltut himself.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As my dear brother Sheikh Mahdavi mentioned, before Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi was the head of Al-Azhar University in Egypt. And we should know this, that Al-Azhar was a university,
yes,
but it was not an ordinary one, because the head of Al-Azhar was chosen by the president of Egypt directly.
Okay.
So, it's not ordinary in, educational system that a president appoints the head of a university. But because Al-Azhar was a flag of Islam at that moment, and even nowadays it is, so it was in that high importance, in that level of importance, that the president of Egypt himself was appointing the chief and the head of this university. So this shows the importance of this university. Before Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi was the head of this university.
Yes.
And we should notice, and we should note this point, that the attempts of Taghrib and trying to get the scholars and the sects of Islam closer to each other, these attempts was started at the time of Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi. And Sheikh Shaltut also was a teacher in Al-Azhar on that moment. He was amongst those ones who were doing their best to collect these scholars and to
let them sit beside each other and have dialogue.
That's right.
But the most important event took place during the time of Sheikh Shaltut.
That's right.
And that was after the establishment of Darut Taghrib. Because Darut Taghrib was the center that was established at the time of Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi. And Sheikh Mahmud Shaltut was also one of the scholars who were amongst the organizers and the establishers, those ones who put the milestone and the, you know, starting point of this, you know,
foundation.
An
institution, that's right.
Institution, yeah.
Okay.
So after the establishment of Darut Taghrib, that we may discuss about it later, this movement started. And day by day, having these dialogues, the scholars came to this point that, okay, we may have some differences, but the common points are much more than the differences that we have.
That's right.
So that's why they came to this point that, okay, let us highlight and put emphasis on the common points and also have scholarly discussions about the differences that we have. But let us forget about fighting each other.
That's right.
Let us forget about, you know, addressing each other as infidel or kafir or mushrik or, you know, some words like this that make people angry and make them to have, you know, severe actions against each other.
Sorry, was the atmosphere on that time over the wall of Islam like today? I mean, the Takfiri ones were in power, or the Wahhabism?
Sure, yeah.
It was an...
You know, okay. The starting point of Darut Taghrib was this.
Mm-hmm.
A Shia Muslim in the Masjid al-Haram.
Yes.
He went for doing Hajj,
yes.
Baytullah al-Haram. And during Hajj, he faced with problem, you know, health problem, and he vomited inside Masjid al-Haram.
Okay.
And the guards of Masjid al-Haram, they took him, arrested him, and put him in court. And they accused him of disrespecting Masjid al-Haram.
Okay.
And the judge, because he was Shia, they said that he was kafir. And he had done this action intentionally inside Masjid al-Haram.
Okay.
So the verdict was execution. And the man was executed inside Mecca. So it was really a shocking news to the Muslim world.
On that time, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
It's something about 10, 15, or the maximum is 20 years before start the establishment of Darut Taghrib.
Okay.
So it shows the atmosphere of Muslim world at that time.
Mm-hmm.
That hatred is among some Muslims in a way that they are accusing a sick man that he unintentionally had vomited inside Masjid al-Haram, but they have executed him.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this action.
Really harsh sentence for
so,
a man.
So, yeah. In this atmosphere, Sheikh Shaltut is trying to get sects beside each other, closer to each other, and putting them under the same umbrella. So, that's why this, you know, efforts are really notable and important.
Very good, very good. Really nice efforts from his side. So, how did he do it? So, in such an atmosphere, in Egypt and Al-Azhar, you know, and we know that socio-political affairs are also playing their roles in the society. So I think Sheikh Mahmud Shaltut's responsibility was really difficult, isn't it, to establish a dialogue between our Sunni brethren and the Shia ones. How did he do it?
Yes, that is a good question. When we read the history, we see that this was not something to take place haphazardly.
Yes.
All of the sudden, you see that such a man is trying to issue the verdict in order to include Shia as the Muslim sect.
Yes.
Actually, as a
Shia was
official.
A Muslim sect. Officially, okay.
Officially.
Yes.
Officially, because this is a very important point, specifically for Sunnis.
Yes.
Why? Because all things that today we see excommunicating of Shias, this is because of the verdict that allowed them, considering Shias out of the Islam. Then they kill. Then they go to executing people. Why?
Yes.
Because they consider them as non-Muslim. So if they are mushrik, if they are kafir, this act of excommunication takes place under this ideology that Shia are not included under Muslim sects.
So we should say that even to non-Muslim such behaviors are condemned, okay, let alone to the Muslims. Okay.
Yes, that's right. So we see that such achievements didn't take place all of the sudden. So when we read the history and the biography of Sheikh Shaltut, we see besides these actions, he was really active in both sides and both grounds, both in theory and action. Mm-hmm. In terms of theory and spreading the theory of Wahda and unification, we see how he started or established the chair for Fiqh al-Muqaran. What is the concept of Fiqh al-Muqaran?
Yes, it is
a comparative study on the Fiqh, jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. So it will enable students to know about other fiqh as well. It is not only to read and study fiqh ahl sunnah. Mm-hmm. When you are talking about fiqh al-muqaran, it enables students to get to know about the jurisprudence of other sects of Islam like Zaydis or Shias.
Okay.
So when they go and study Shia jurisprudence, they will find on their own that there are a lot of similarities that they are not told about it. So this opportunity to bring about this opportunity and chances for the student and new generation to get to know about other sects will pave the ground for the moment that you want to establish the unity in the ground.
Okay.
I mean, in action.
Okay.
So this is one of the things that he did. And besides this, we have to say that the good communication that he had with Ayatollah Burujerdi in Iran, who would consider as the main leader or marja in Iran, of the Shia.
Yes.
So this is also one of the good action which give this picture that if those people, meaning Shia, are not considered as Muslim, if they are deserve to be treated that way that my brother mentioned in Mecca, how the head of Al-Azhar is establishing relationship and communication with the head of Shia in the world of Islam. So we have to look at these actions that he took.
Yes.
So when we read the history, we come to this point that Sheikh Shaltut, he was not only the man of speech or talking or only talking about the theories.
Yes.
We know how it is difficult to take the political stance specifically against Israel. So he was one of the people who took a very severe stance against the invasion of Israel.
That's right.
And interestingly, after the arrest of Ayatollah Khomeini, Imam Khomeini, before the revolution, it was known of Ayatollah Khomeini, in the demonstration of June 1963, he also took a very harsh stance against the Shah of Iran. He made a telegraph to the Shah of Iran that you are not allowed to disrespect. So these kind of action, if we put all of them all together, will pave the ground for Sheikh Shaltut and will give him this position to lead this movement, I mean the movement of unity and unification among the Shia sects.
Okay.
So based on what I said at the beginning of this discussion, we also must take into consideration one very important point. What is that point? Is that all these actions are taking place when he is reaching his 60s. So at that time, he is a mature, knowledgeable
man.
He was not a young man to say because of getting excited of some sort of news, he had taken these actions. And at that time, when he was 63, he was leading Al-Azhar University. So having all those knowledge about Sunnism, including Shia as one of the Muslim sects, and issuing this verdict publicly that no one has right to disrespect them. Even you can actually lead your salat behind them. You can pray your salat behind them.
Even he did it behind
Ayatollah
Kashif al-Ghita.
He himself did it. So these actions empowered him of getting this position in the world of Islam.
That's all right. Very good. Very great achievements by Sheikh Mahmud Shaltut. He has also several books. The most outstanding one is a tafsir I think this taqribi look, I think, can be seen in his tafsir or exegesis of the Holy Quran too. Okay, Sheikh Zainia, your final words about him. Do you have anything to say?
Beside all these efforts that my dear brother Sheikh Mahdavi mentioned, we should notice that acting in accordance with your beliefs is not easy, and you should take hard steps. And Sheikh Shaltut took these steps. For example, Majma' al-Bayan is a very famous exegesis on Holy Quran written by Marhum al-Tabarsi rahmatullah alayhi. And Majma' al-Bayan is a tafsir in which we see that the theories and the ideas of Sunni scholars are also reflected in this tafsir. And Sheikh Shaltut, according to a wise decision, decided to write an introduction for this tafsir. So he introduced Majma' al-Bayan to the world of Sunni scholars. Mm-hmm. That, look, this is a Shia tafsir, this is a Shia commentary on the Holy Quran, and it's full of the ideas of Sunni scholars.
Interesting.
So how do you blame these this school of thought to be, you know, not a part of Islam?
Mm-hmm.
While their scholars are reflecting our ideas.
That's right.
Besides this, one of the very important points that Sheikh Shaltut insisted on it and tried to break the atmosphere against this action is that, you know, the day of Ashura amongst some of Sunni communities or some of Sunni Muslims is known as Eid.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately,
okay.
And many of them, they are not aware of the event that took place in this day.
Yes.
I've even witnessed myself in different countries in Africa that people are not aware of the story that took place in this day. And they say, okay, this is the day of fasting. That's why Sheikh Shaltut tried to have the gathering and mourning ceremony for the martyrdom of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam in the day of Ashura in Al-Azhar University.
Very good.
And this is very important,
mm-hmm.
that in the heart of the ideology of Sunni school of thought, that is Al-Azhar,
okay.
you held a ceremony for the sake of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam, the grandson of the Holy Prophet, and to keep the memory of the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, to make people aware of what happened.
That's right.
And to let them know that, okay, be respectful toward the grandson of Holy Prophet.
Yes.
So Sheikh Shaltut was taking very wise steps in this regard,
mm-hmm.
forgetting about the differences, of course, not neglecting. There are some, you know, differences, but overlooking the differences and try to highlight the common points as Quran tells us regarding our inner relationship with non-Muslims. قُلْ يَا أَهْلَ الْكِتَابِ تَعَالَوْا إِلَىٰ كَلِمَةٍ سَوَاءٍ بَيْنَنَا وَبَيْنَكُمْ أَلَّا نَعْبُدَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ. So it's more emphasis regarding the Muslims themselves. So if we have to talk with non-Muslims, it's obvious that yes. we are more in need to have dialogue with Muslims. So Sheikh Shaltut was amongst those figures that did his best in this regard. And paid also for this
That's
way.
Right.
May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless his soul.
And also paved the way, I think, for the next generation of the you know, coming generation of Sunni brethren to establish dialogue with our Shiite ones around the world. And this is a look that Islam really needs in today's world in order to forget the bias, prejudice, you know, and extremism and get to the main pillars of Islam. Thank you very much about his demise. 1963, coinciding with 1383, according to the Hijra calendar, he passed away in Cairo in Egypt and was buried over there. Thank you much, Sheikh Zainia and Sheikh Mahdavi, for a nice elaboration on the life of Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, one of the most outstanding Sunni brethren and one of the establishers of Dar al-Taghrib Bain al-Mazahib al-Islami. It was very kind of you, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com. /EN Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode introducing another Shiite dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Muallim. Peaceful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.